Welcome to the Ugly Dog Podcast, where we talk about bird dogs, wild places, conservation, and the journeys that bring them all together. I'm Mike Nadeski, and on this episode, we learn how Nina Hoekstra transitioned from the deer stand to the uplands and the transformation that comes with solo travel. We also talk about her spiritual connection and how it manifests in the natural world and how she's taking the leap into working in outdoor media full-time. Enjoy! Hey everyone, welcome back to the Ugly Dog Podcast. I'm sitting down with Nina Hoekstra. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Perfect. here in the lovely hunt cabin at the Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club. This is awesome. It's May. It's going to be beautiful. But at the same time, there's this beautiful stone fireplace in front of us. I kind of wish that it was on, but we are beyond that season finally.
This would be good in winter.
It would be.
Yeah. Cozy.
Glass of whiskey or hot coffee. It'd be perfect. Thank you so much for sitting down fresh off of the Pheasants Forever on the Wing podcast.
Yes.
You're on the circuit now.
Apparently. Yeah.
How was that?
It was a very good time. We had a great conversation about volunteering and why we care about it so much. So I hope that other people will feel inspired to care as well.
Yeah. What was your biggest takeaway from that experience?
We had a great conversation. I think one of my favorite things that I noticed in the conversation was how I could sit there with people of such different ages. And I mentioned this in the podcast and relate to, we could have four different people in a room, all different backgrounds, all different styles, lifestyles, whatnot. And I'll be able to enjoy the same topic of hunting and conservation. So that was definitely one of my biggest takeaways.
Yeah. And that was for folks that don't know, you should listen to Bob St. Pierre and Pheasants Forever's On the Wing podcast. That was about hands-on habitat month, which is now.
Yes, the month of May.
Okay. So what did you do for that?
Yes. So our project unfortunately got canceled. It was supposed to be last weekend, but we have it rescheduled in the next couple of weeks. So we're going to be doing, there's a specific tract of public land that is under our umbrella in our chapter that they did a burn on just recently. And a lot of the trees did not actually get hit by the burn at all. Oh. So there's a lot of you know, volunteer trees that need to get taken care of. So we are going to be doing kind of a weeknight evening rather than taking people's weekends and utilizing just a few hours of people's time to get rid of some trees. So that way our birds can have some good habitat.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, forest creep and prairie grass is a very real thing.
Yeah, so it's a problem for sure. You know,
and burning generally helps, but if you don't get it hot enough or whatever the conditions might be, if it's too wet.
Absolutely.
Then you're up the creek. So do you know what you're, are you doing slash and spray or are you just cutting it all out?
I think it's just going to be cut. The DNR contacted us about the piece in particular and said this didn't go very well when we tried to burn it. We could use some volunteers to take care of that. So I think they're just looking for a cut.
Okay. Nice. Awesome. Well, I'm really excited to sit down and have this conversation with you from a number of fronts. So we got to know each other a little bit via social media and then met at Pheasant Fest because you were there moonlighting for Horse and Hunt Club with Nikki, and your booth was conveniently right across from us, so we couldn't escape. And it's been wonderful to get to know you. Obviously, your social media presence is fantastic for folks that don't follow you. Just Instagram?
Mainly, yeah.
Okay? In Nina's Nature.
Yes.
I'll make sure I tag that in the show notes so folks can find you. So I know very little about your background. How did you get here?
Oh boy. So I was originally an archery hunter. I grew up archery hunting. Okay. We never had guns in the home actually. Or at least as long as I can remember. I know my dad was into gun hunting before us kids came along, but then when we came along, we did just archery hunting. So I started pulling back a bow at about age five. So I've been doing it for over 20 years, which is wild. And then as soon as I could pull it enough poundage that I could go hunting, we were there. So, got into, deer hunting primarily and did that through, really college. Kind of had a little bit of a falling out of time where I was in a bad relationship that took me away from all of that. And The reason I care so much about hunting and why it is so important to me at such a root level is because hunting kind of saved me out of that relationship and the outdoors. God used the outdoors to save me out of that relationship. My dad and I, it was the fall of 2017. My dad and I were going hunting for deer opener, and we were going to put up a new tree stand in a property that he just got permission on. We were out in the woods. It was a really high tree. We were like 25 feet in the air, and I'm putting up this stand and we're working together. And it was just this moment of like stillness that I looked out over this land that was crop in one area and grasslands in another and trees. And I realized that if I stayed in the relationship I was currently in, I would not see any more of that in my life. Mm-hmm. Like this would not be part of my life. And so I came out of the woods and my dad and I sat down. Unfortunately, a thunderstorm came in, and so we got like rained on. So we're coming out of the woods and we get back to the pickup, and I was like, I got to tell you something. I hadn't told my parents like any of the red flags I was experiencing and whatnot in the relationship. And I just broke down and was sobbing to him. I was like, I don't know what to do. I think I need to get out. I don't know how to get out. And so he and I just, like a good father, helped me figure out a plan, and we figured it out. And so the outdoors really, really saved me. And then that same fall, I learned to upland hunt. Within like a month later, I think it was, my dad was like, I just got into upland hunting. We should go to this game farm. I was like, okay. And boy, was pheasant hunting fun.
Wow.
Nina. And the rest kind of history. So
and here you are. So that was 7-8 years ago now.
Yeah.
First, thank you for sharing. That's really powerful.
Not to cry. maybe you got that.
You wouldn't be the first one to cry on the podcast. Sorry, Des, I'm outing you.
What is with this podcast?
it's my counselor background. Truly, I want to be serious. Like, thank you for sharing that. I have a background in working with folks in that, and so as well as my own personal history, and so talking about faith in the outdoors is certainly was on my rough shot outline here. I didn't know we were gonna get there.
That
right
was
now
really deep,
but no, I it is incredible the power that the outdoors has to create those scenarios. Like you said, it was you were sharing, thinking about, you mentioned like this big thunderstorm comes in and sort of chases you out of the tree and into the truck. It had that not happened, would you have had the space to have that conversation?
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know. It was definitely like a reflective moment up there. I remember, I don't think I'll ever forget looking out over that field and being, there's just, God just hit me with it of like, what are you going to do? Cause this isn't going to be the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And I care enough about the outdoors and what it brings me by connecting with the Lord in that, that it was like, this matters. Like I need to care about this, and I need to care about this intervention that's about to happen.
Well, and how powerful for that to be with your dad and to have such a wonderful relationship with your dad, to feel safe and be able to lean into that safety and that trust to have that conversation and develop a plan and go do all of those things.
Absolutely.
That is incredible. So we're going to come back to the spirituality piece.
Yes.
Talk to me about the upland thing. So you didn't grow up with guns in the home. You grew up bow hunting and shooting a bow and archery. Like because you use the word archery, like competitive archery?
No, hunting.
Just hunting, bow hunting.
Yes, okay. Bow hunting. I'm
a redneck, so I just like...
Oh, no, it's fine. Yeah. Archery was a fantastic outlet for me, and obviously I did it in a lot of different ways. You know, there's shooting sports through 4-H as a kid and things like that. And it was a fantastic way for my dad and I to do something together, outdoors. And, I even got to coach archery. Like I've coached archery for kids now later in my adult years and things like that. So that's been, I still love it. And thankfully it's to the point that I cannot shoot my bow for many, many months, and I can pick it up and guarantee it's going to go where I want it to, which is awesome. Like, I'm so grateful for that. Yeah. Archer is truly a muscle memory thing for me at this point. It's taken me a lot of years to get to that, but I'm really thankful for it. And it's brought me a lot of cool experiences. I got to go solo elk hunting in Idaho. Wow. That was really cool. That was in 2021. Life-changing experience as well. It's thankfully, it's still just, like I said, that muscle memory, because now I have this dog that I love so much and spend so much time with, and I want to be out in the field with him. And when I want to go archery hunting, I can thankfully pick up all my gear and go do it, and I don't have to think much about it. But a lot of times I'm choosing the shotgun now over the bow.
Awesome. I tell you, I grew up a deer hunter. I didn't grow up with bird dogs. Mm-hmm. And I got into bow hunting in my 20s because where I grew up hunting, I could hunt with a rifle for a really long time. But then when I moved to the Midwest, you can't.
Right.
I started bow hunting. And that's part of what drove me into bird dogs, was I got a wire hair and a blood track deer because I had started bow hunting.
I didn't know that.
And now I got the bird dog and I'm like, I'm going to put the first doe in the freezer that comes within bow range or gun range.
Yep.
And call it good.
I know.
And then I'm going bird hunting.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do now. And at the same time, though, because I did kind of do the trophy thing for a while, the trophy chase, I guess you could say, I still have a really hard time actually like pulling back the bow and doing the deed, because I'm like, oh, maybe there's going to be something else.
Yeah, I don't.
So bad.
I don't.
I need to get to that point.
Have you shot a couple of big deer? Or
I've thankfully had moments. I mean, there was the season before I got Redland, I spent like over 150 hours bow hunting.
Wow.
And I've seen a lot of really nice deer. Yeah. Unfortunately then just never gotten to actually like pull back and and drawn one. So
yeah,
I think it's just that almost there experience.
Yeah. You need the fine. That's the reason I asked that is because I've shot a couple of big deer and I'm like, okay.
Okay. Like, you've done it. Right. It's like checked off kind of thing.
I love it. And if I was ever in a position to have my own piece of property and do more management, it all goes hand in hand. The more that I do this and learn about conservation and land management, for folks, it's very Southeast specific, but for folks that they're really into the habitat management, if you have land, I can't recommend Southeast Whitetail enough. Both the website and the podcast, Mark, down there, he's in Georgia. They manage a big piece of property, but for deer. So they were the Quality Deer Management Association back when that was still an association. They were the habitat managers of the year 2019, 2020. Mm-hmm. And I got to go deer hunting down there for a mentored hunt. And the most jacked part of that weekend for me was I was sitting in a deer stand and I watching the sun come up and I look and here comes this covey of quail scurrying out from the brush, feeding out in this cart path. And him and I have started all of these conversations about like doing proper deer habitat management, particularly with like feeding and bedding cover and forestry management, both economically and for wildlife. Mm-hmm. Their quail population is like exploding.
Really?
And
that's epic.
And so I look at that and I go, and you could apply that to pheasants and
absolutely
waterfowl and a number, even rough grouse. The amount of deer trails and shed antlers and deadheads I find grouse hunting, in 10-year cutovers.
Absolutely.
Is incredible. So I would love to get back to it at some point. At the same time, it's really hard to leave the dog at home.
Absolutely. And I think too, the more you get into like I private land hunt when I'd go deer hunting, but it's all on other people's property. Like we don't have our own property right now to do that on. And I think the more you get into it in terms of understanding whitetails and like you said, management and things like that, the more I want to be able to manage and I can't currently because I don't have that property. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it a lot harder. I think I started to gain a bit of a difficult perspective I wish this was different, but I can't change it because I can't tell the neighbors or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it lost a little bit of its luster too, in terms of like, I wish I could manage, but I don't have that power at the moment.
Yeah.
So maybe someday I will get to, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. You will. I'm very confident of that. So you get out of this relationship.
Yes.
And at the same time, your dad starts upland hunting.
Yes.
Random.
Super random. It was so random, especially since we never had like guns in the home. Mm-hmm. Like I remember when he first was like, I'm just trying some pheasant hunting. I was like, you're what?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think when I even shot my first gun. Like I really can't put, I mean, I know it was, I don't even know if I did in, as a kid, honestly. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. And I feel like because it's not memorable enough, I probably didn't. I don't think it was until I was an adult. Okay. And I didn't even know what I was doing, you know? So,
yeah.
Which who does? But yeah, so when he brought me, I mean, I think I used like our buddies or maybe my pastor's like Remington Youth 870 or mm-hmm. something like that. And just went with it, figured it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then we went a few times that same game farm was local to us, and I got to keep watching like good friends' dogs. So every time we go, we bring some different people, or we go mm-hmm. with some different people. So I'd see a Brittany or a Vishla or a German Shorthair or a Lab, you know, and I kept mm-hmm. just getting to see all these different upland dogs working, and it was so cool to me. Mm-hmm. But at the time, like I wanted a dog, but it wasn't really in the cards. And it just, it was kind of like a, well, this is really neat.
Sure.
I don't really know how it applies, but it's really neat, you know? So then I just started getting to it more, at a very casual level, like when we go to the game farm or something mm-hmm. like that. And then I met my husband, let's see, it would have been like a year-ish later, a little less.
Okay.
And he is a very devout upland hunter.
Okay.
He has this, had a Springer Spaniel, and they're really into it. And so then once I had more of an avenue of like, okay, we've got the dog, I have someone that can help me in terms of gear a little bit more, things mm-hmm. like that, or walk me through what things look like, then I got to start learning more about like cover and what a good property looks like for upland hunting, or how the dog actually works, or what a birdie dog looks like. And so I got to get this kind of basis mm-hmm. from my experiences with them. And then my husband and I got married in 2019, and by that time we were just full-fledged into upland hunting, and I had yet to go by myself. Mm-hmm. So then the first time I went by myself, I took Diesel, the 13-year-old Springer Spaniel at the time, out by myself, and he still had a lot of go in him. So that mm-hmm. was not a concern. He was maybe 12. And it was a super crummy day. It was snowing. It was windy. I was worried. Diesel was deaf, so I was worried he wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to hear me. And even like the whistle sometimes wasn't enough, or like sometimes his collar wasn't enough for him. If he got on a bird, he might be gone. Yep. So I was really worried about that. But him and I went out there, and he did know hand signals. So if he looked at you and you gave him a hand signal, then he could go with that.
Take it.
And that was wild. Mm-hmm. I mean, to go with like the first time going by yourself with a dog that roughly knows cues.
Yeah.
Like I got to work as a team mm-hmm. for the first time, rather than my husband Mark kind of handling all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big day for me. I remember I took some random selfie with Diesel smashed up against my face. Like I made him sit there and I held his face to mine, and I was so happy. Like I don't think we got any birds. I think I probably shot a bunch of birds. It was a terrible shot for a really long time.
Yeah.
But that changed everything for me. And so then I started bugging my husband about, let's get a dog. Let's get a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we can, I mean, we can talk about Redland too, if you want to.
Of course. But, yes. Yeah. So, is Diesel still around?
No,
okay.
He passed away last 2 Januarys ago. So
gotcha.
Yeah, early 2023.
Never fun.
Oh, I know. He had a great life.
It sounds it. So you got Redland when?
Yes. Would have been spring of 21.
Okay.
Yes.
Redland's your only dog.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So he's 3 now. And getting, he's a lab, a red lab. And that was a process. I looked at so many different breeds. I'm a research type. So mm-hmm. if I make a decision finally on something, you probably can guess I've spent about 6 months trying to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I like spoke with so many different breeders and so many different kennels, and just trying to narrow down what would be a good fit for us. Obviously, we live in Minnesota, and it gets cold here. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I wanted some dog that had some hardiness to them. And we do upland hunt in all conditions, you know, so it couldn't be, oh, it's, you know, under 30 degrees or under 20 degrees. Like, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. No, like, yeah, it can't be a problem. Like, we're going to be out if it's negatives or whatever.
Yeah.
So I kept scouring what breed would be a good fit. And I think it's kind of hilarious that I end up on a lab, like, just because they're the, you know, the man's best friend kind of bird dogs. Sure. I don't know. Like, it seemed like the very generic thing to get,
oh,
I guess.
Okay.
Like the irony of it, you know, like, oh, I looked at all these breeds. I did all this research and I still ended up with a lab.
Well, damn it. That I hear you. I think that the challenge that some folks have is, and this is a me opinion, the research can, you folks want to be contrarian or esoteric and those types of things.
Yes. Unique.
And at
in
the
whatever
same
way.
Time, you know, I've said this before and I'll die on, like, the best bird dog for you is the one that makes you happy and that will find birds and retrieve them for you.
Yeah.
At the same time, from like a utilitarian perspective, if you want a flushing dog, it's really hard to argue with a well-bred, well-trained athletic lab.
Absolutely.
It really, I mean, like, there are people that are going to be like, I can't believe you said that. Like, I've hunted with a lot of damn breeds and they're good ones are really good.
Mm-hmm. And he's proved that time and time again, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. And of course we duck hunt occasionally too. So it was like, we can't have a dog that doesn't like water or won't retrieve in water, things like that. So yeah, he's definitely been, and he'll point sometimes too, which is exciting. Okay. He does that naturally. He's a cool dog.
Yeah.
So you're
saying like all the contrarian things today. Like, I know. I got a lab and it's got a great dog and it points and all
that. I promise I did not teach my lab to point.
No. Well, it's funny. I have some friends with a lab and this is 100% of the truth. I, for the longest time, was like, pointing labs are croc. Like that it is.
Yeah.
Now, is that as a trait in labs a fault? Yes. Right. They're not
an
a pointing
accidental.
Dog. They're, right. It's a genetic, you know, every dog really had a pointing instinct because they all come from wolves. So it's sort of the pause before the pounce, and like labs or flushing dogs, they were bred to basically alleviate that and just accentuate the go get. The facet, but at the same time, I was always like, this is BS. I'm hunting in Iowa in January with a buddy of mine who is now an avid judge, has short hair and wire hair, and they have a lab. And we're hunting a cattail slough. It's like 5 degrees.
Yeah.
And we're hunting a cattail slough. And I look over and his wire hair has like is slick, but it has a really big blocky head.
Okay.
So I look over the cattail slough like 40 yards away and I'm like, oh, their wire hair is on point. I'm a NAVDA senior judge. I see a lot of dogs point. Like, I'm like, this dog is pointing.
Right. Hard
period.
Point.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, the Iver's on point. And I get like 15 yards away and it moves. And I was like, that's not Iver. That's their lab.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, you have seen the light, yes. Mike. And so, you know, they do it.
Yes.
There are way more that are more trained to point, if you will, than have a natural proclivity. But this, I was like, okay.
Well, it's
color
incredible.
Be converted.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite points that I've ever watched Redland do was in Montana this past year. My husband and I were both there. I had taken a solo trip to Montana and I said, we got to go back. Mm-hmm. So then we went back and we had just gotten our limit for the day. So then we got to just relax and have the camera out as we were walking back to the car and stuff. Mm-hmm. And made a long trek back and there was still lots of birds. So of course we just let Redland do his thing. And all of a sudden he goes super hard lock on this brush area. And I was like, Mark, look, you know, and I get the phone out and I did get video of it and I he helped for probably 5 seconds or so before he pounced in. And oddly enough, usually when Redland points, you can guarantee there's a bird there. That was an unusual time, but I loved his point. It was an incredible point to watch. But yeah, he's had some really good ones and
that's awesome.
I think I enjoy it. While it's not a true point, I mean, ideally, you know, a true pointing dog would hold and all that stuff. I would never make Redland do that. I enjoy the way that it causes him to slow down. Mm-hmm. Obviously, flushing dogs, they can sometimes, you're running.
You are
running through that field sometimes to keep up with them when they're hard charging. And I appreciate when he can lock a bird in like that and it gives us a chance to enjoy it. And, you know, get ready and stuff. So yeah. I think that's kind of my favorite part of it.
Yeah.
Unintentionally, that something we've fallen in love with.
For sure. You know? Yeah. So did you train Redland yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was all DIY.
Okay.
It was very hard. And I learned a lot of hard lessons, as most people will say when they've trained their first bird dog.
What was hard?
I learned of myself that I did not have the patience at times that it required. He's taught me a lot about that since then and gaining that and just looking at training in a perspective of how can I help him grasp this and let him be successful was a whole new lens. I think growing up, any dogs that we did have around, it was when you're teaching them a new trick, maybe you're going to try and like, oh, I'm going to test them and like, see if they can do this. And like, that's not the point of dog training. Like we are trying to allow them to be successful. We're trying to give them wins. Even I catch my husband still doing something like that. Sometimes I'm like, Mark, it's not how we train something.
Yeah. It's hard. So for folks that don't know, on our Instagram feed, I do on every Friday, I do a Q&A and somebody just asked about something about training and I went on a mini rant about training versus testing.
Absolutely.
And I still do it. I was literally training yesterday, duck search, for NAVDA utility test with Mac and a friend of mine. And there was a part of me that was like, no, just let her go. Like just trying to give her more freedom as opposed to direction. She was clearly confused. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to default to, they'll figure it out.
Oh yeah.
Or they should know this.
Right.
And we don't zoom out. I love that you talked about patience because it's so hard sometimes to back up and go, what do I need to set this up to be successful? Mm-hmm. Even if, especially a lot of us really achievement oriented.
Yes.
So we want to get to the thing and it's like, I need to make this simple and easy and stair-step this.
Yes.
And it's easy to get tired of the first three steps.
Totally.
Especially, skip to step six.
Yes. And especially when all those steps are necessary. Mm-hmm. If you skip over something because you think it's not a big deal or you think your dog will figure it out, they will not. And you will find that you will have to redo something. Like, I didn't force fetch, for example. I didn't know enough about force fetching. I didn't really look up the concept enough to understand that it's not painful, or it's not supposed to be painful. Sure. It's not supposed to be, you know, this grotesque movement in terms of like harsh on the dog or anything like that. And so I just said, you know what, I'm going to fetch training him a different way. And I did. And I ended up having to force fetch him at a year and a half, I think, I don't remember how we came across it. I mean, he was picking up birds and then all of a sudden he wasn't, basically. Mm. At first he was retrieving everything just fine when it came to, I think it was because it was ducks. We started with ducks and it was waterfowl season first. Mm-hmm. I think when that year and a half old, however, he would have been his second season. And we were like, great, it's going great. He's picking up ducks. And then we got to pheasants and he wouldn't pick up a pheasant. Hmm. Wouldn't do it. It was because, I don't know if it was because the feathers were dry and he didn't like how it felt or something, but I realized that I had missed a very integral step in his training. And so we went back and in my head at times when I saw all these other dogs on, whether it be social media or, you know, watching cool videos of these dogs doing it or see my friends' dogs and things, you get caught up and think, my dog just knows how to do that. They're like a natural retriever. It'll be fine.
Sure.
But the whole process of force fetching made him the dog he is today, and he's an incredible dog because of it. An incredible hunter. And so that those steps are all very important. And I think trying to get caught up in, no, I just want to move on before your dog is ready. Your dog will, this is a cliche saying, cause I've heard it many times through different, your dog will like tell you or show you when they're ready, or you kind of have to, it is a matter of learning to read your dog.
It is.
And that's a hard skill to learn. But it, again, patience and, being receptive to what they're trying to tell you. And also just, if you're having a bad day,
don't train.
No. Oh my gosh, don't train. Yeah. It's, your dog won't be worse off for missing a day, but he will be worse off if that day goes bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you can do way more damage.
Yes.
Yeah. What method, or did you follow like a prescription for force fetch?
I thankfully did. When I found out the problem existed, I started calling around to different trainers in my area and kennels, and basically was like, help. I need help. I don't know what to do. I've messed up. And there was a trainer local to me that he's great. He ended up being a mentor to me, a dog training mentor to me. And he was like, I got time like this afternoon. I was like, I'm coming over right now. And so he walked me through just the process of, gosh, where do we start? We probably started just with like being up on a table or a pedestal or whatever. And then just lightly introducing like a dowel or something like that. And then working into birds. And I mean, that took, it took months. And looking back now, it's like, oh, he probably would have been a lot more receptive to that as a puppy and would have not taken probably months. But even still, it was worth the time, every amount of it. So. Yeah, well,
it's one of those, in particularly in today's day and age, right? We want to get there now. I've done force fetch or trained retrieve or whatever you want to call it on a number of dogs. And it is, to do it well, it requires 2 to 3 months.
Yes.
You know, to really to go from hold and carry through pressure, through e-collar introduction, to piles, to birds, to shot birds, to water. You know, there are people that are going to say that they could do it faster, but I would always, for me, I would allot that amount of time. And does that seem like a lot of time right now? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is it a lot of time in the life of a 13-year-old dog?
No.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Is it a lot of time when you're standing in the duck blind and you sail one and the dog won't go?
Won't go. Yep.
There's eons that you would give up to be able to have
that dog. It becomes invaluable.
Absolutely. And it's critical. The more, you know, it's no different than you or I can't go run a marathon tomorrow.
Right.
So you've got to build into it.
Yeah.
In that good for you, like to be able to know, to see a challenge, to not accept it, to not go, oh, well, this is just what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And then to problem solve and to get help. Folks' dogs are way more capable of what they give them credit for. It's just whether they're going to put the effort in.
Absolutely.
To accomplish it.
Yeah. So no, that was a fantastic experience for me to learn. And now I know.
Yeah.
For good next for
you.
Time.
Yeah. Well, you don't know what you don't know.
Absolutely.
That's become a sort of a theme that we continue to talk about. Like we're always learning. Mm-hmm. And when you get another dog, you'll learn.
Yes.
And they'll do something different and there'll be mistakes there. And how do you navigate that? So talk to me about solo trips.
Yeah. Oh boy. I got the hunch. So my first solo trip that I went on was, but besides some like occasional vacations, cause I'll do like true hunting solo trip, was going to Idaho elk hunting.
Okay.
And basically solo trips came out of me being frustrated as a female, really became as a woman, like wanting to go do something and kind of just, no one in particular said this to me. Like it wasn't like my husband or my parents or anything like that. It's just that stigma of you can't go because it's not safe.
Sure.
And I was just irritated with that. Yes, it is. That's very correct. It is not safe. I've been on multiple solo trips now that I could have planned better. Okay. I've learned, and I've been in some situations I've thought to myself, like, thank God that he was watching over me and made that go a certain way. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I could have been in a really bad spot. Mm-hmm. And whatnot. So solo trips really came as an inspiration from wishing I could go and do something and then being tired of wishing.
Sure.
So when I got the idea to go elk hunting solo, it's mm-hmm. just funny even to like think about it. I had been listening to Elk 101, like Elk Talk podcasts by Corey Jacobson and Randy Newberg, and they had been talking about going elk hunting in the early season of September mm-hmm. with like archery hunting and finding bulls like in their bedroom was what they kind of, and if you have any elk hunting experience, people would be like, yeah, yeah, that's a big deal. But if you don't, that's what it, you just try and find bulls will separate off yeah. from like right before they get to their herd and they kind of just hide out. And they're easily provoked, I guess you could say mm-hmm. during this time frame. And I thought it'd be really cool to try it. I had this, you know, you pay a lot of money to go yeah. and have these tags and prepare for this season and have all this gear. And I had planned to go with some buddies like later on in the season for like a week, but I was irritated that I wasn't going at a time when I really, really wanted to. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I think I'm going to drive the 18 hours to Idaho by myself and go. Mm-hmm. And so I went. And it took some convincing to, you know, let my husband say yes to letting me go do this.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, I was like, I'm going to go do this and we're just going to figure it out. Yeah, I love you and I'll see you on the flip side. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible. You get so much empowerment from doing this. Mm-hmm. Now, I will not say it was without its trials. I think I cried every single day I was out there just because trying to hunt and plan and be prepared and all these things while carrying 30 to 40 pounds on your back mm-hmm. and like all the training that you've done never seems like enough.
No.
Once you're out there. And so, yeah, it was just a very emotional experience. Probably sounds very feminine to say that, but it was really hard. Like every day you just were faced with these different challenges of not only am I making sure I'm in the right spot to go hunting or moving to a different trailhead if I need to, but it's eating. It's the basic necessities that like kind of get stripped to the bones mm-hmm. when you're out there. And I was not very good at being by myself like at first. And I ended up going for 5 or 6 days, I think total. Unfortunately I had to leave. I had planned to go longer. I had to leave early. I ended up having, boot issues that were kind of beyond repair. Like my feet, unfortunately, if anyone's been out uh-huh. west, once you lose your feet, you are done. Yes. And so, after 4 or 5 days of trying to like manage those, I kind of just like, I don't think I can keep going. But yeah, it was really hard. And so that was an experience. And then since then I've done a few different trips. My most recent one was going to Montana, solo bird hunting, mm-hmm. That with just Redland and I, and that had been something I'd wanted to do was go to like a different state for birds for a while, like for the past few years. And my husband does Minnesota deer hunting, like rifle up north. Mm-hmm. And so he was doing that the weekend of November. And I was like, I can't do anything kind of hunting around here. I don't feel safe doing it with Redland. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to go somewhere that I can. And so I did the research. That's hilarious. Anyone that has learned about my solo elk trip, solo trips knows that I rarely do any research before I do my trips. I'm a researcher when it comes to gear and stuff that I'm going to buy. But for some reason, when it comes to trips, I've learned the best thing to do is just go.
Yeah.
The more time you spend researching, the less likely you are to mm-hmm. go because you'll probably talk yourself out of it.
For sure.
So I usually just go. And that's what I did. And I happened to plan a few things. I met some girls out in North Dakota, like Western North Dakota, went hunting with them for a day or two. And then traversed on to solo hunting in Montana for, I think, 3 or 4 days. Again, incredibly mm-hmm. hard to just manage everything by yourself. I will say solo hunting with a dog, I found to be incredibly more, focused, I guess you could say. Like, he gave me a sense of, okay, he needs to eat. Okay, we need to get back to the hotel so we can prepare for tomorrow. We need to both get rest. When I was elk hunting out west, I was so nervous about, like, I was in grizzly country, unfortunately, and I was so nervous about, like, bears and things like that, that I wouldn't even stop to, like, eat. Mm-hmm. So I would hike for like 10 to 13 miles and I wouldn't have any snacks because I was so nervous about food and bears.
Yeah.
So that was like a way different experience than hunting with Redland and being like, we both need a snack or we both need some water. We both need to rest. We've been out here all day. We need to get back to the hotel. Like,
well, there's the level of direction. Companionship too.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And now at this point, I feel a lot more prepared for solo hunts. This past year, I got like stuck in what do they call it? Gumbo mud. They call it in Montana. I think you've experienced some of that before too. Yeah. And that stuff's wild. You will never get your vehicle out of it. and I was out in the middle of nowhere. I had just lost service like a few miles back. And I was like, thankfully I have my Garmin, but I was like, I don't know what to do. I mean, I could press the SOS button on here, but what kind of Calvary does that bring?
Yeah.
And so it was like, I was praying. Actually, I was like walking along gravel road with Redland. I was praying. I was like, God, you've gotten me out of situations like this in the past. This is not the first time I've had, you know, up the creek without a paddle moment out hunting.
Yeah.
And, in the middle of nowhere, a UPS driver came by, which he was like, I never go on this route. Like, I was crazy. And like after meeting some locals, they were like, you found a UPS driver? Like they said, like, no one ever comes out here. And that guy was like, oh, I don't have any service either. But he was kind of on a route, you know, and I was like, you know what? It's fine. Like, don't worry about it. I appreciate you at least stopped. If you happen to get service, call me in, you know, but if I need to, I'll press the SOS button on my Garmin. And I'd sent a message to my husband, like with my coordinates, kind of. My husband didn't maybe think the way I'd wanted him to. I should have tried to say more of like, can you call 911, please? I need a tow truck.
Sure.
But that guy that I met, like the UPS driver, went miles down the road and happened to get service and was thought to like actually call me in, which was, he didn't have to do that. Like he had a route to be on. He came back then and was like, I called you in. They're coming. I was like, oh my gosh. So about like 45 minutes later, trooper showed up and then he called a tow. And
nice.
So yeah, that was Montana. I was getting stuck in gumbo mud.
Okay.
So now I'll know to bring either, I don't know, beefier tires, a winch. I don't know. I'm going to attach something to my Subaru to make it so I can get out of that on my own.
Just being cognizant of what gumbo looks like.
Yes.
And not.
Now you know. Now I know, right? don't drive into that.
Yeah. It's the same with, you know, like east-west roads in Kansas and stuff when it's, you know, it freezes and then the sun comes up and it thaws and it's
so bad.
It might as well be an ice rink.
Yeah.
Those are not fun. What's your recommendation? So I'm going to go right at this because this is a philosophy of mine. You brought up like the emotionality of doing it by yourself and like how you feel like it's a more feminine thing. I call BS on that because I've done it and I haven't done it big game hunting, but I've done it bird hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And it is wild to be in a place that there's so much responsibility and analysis paralysis, and it's overwhelming.
Yes.
Of like, where do I go? What, like, when do I eat? What do I like? All of these things, as well as then, at least for me, I can remember being in the Panhandle, Oklahoma, and walking into a breakfast diner, and like it was the typical like, open the door, and the 12 farmers at the table like turn and were like, "Boy, you ain't from around here." And like that, in today's day and age, particularly for folks our age, that's really foreign.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I want to do more of it. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to say is like, it's emotional in my opinion, regardless of gender. What are your recommendations for folks that want to do something like that?
Absolutely. First, like make a goal of it. That was something like for me, it was something I wanted to do for years with Redland before I finally said, you know, it's happening, but make a goal and then do your best to stick with it. You know, put a timeline on it. Say the season of 2024, I'm going to a new state. Mm-hmm. You don't have to necessarily say like where yet. Just I'm going to a new state. And maybe once you've done a little research, you know, there's plenty of podcasts. There's plenty of like The Flush. That was actually where I first heard of Montana was The Flush. Mm-hmm. I heard a 5-second blip of it and thought I should go to Montana.
Yeah.
and then from there, I think, I don't know. I want to say something about like being safe. Like I always carry, for example, mm-hmm. when I'm out. And while I do have training with all that, it doesn't necessarily make you safe, you know, like,
sure.
But it does help. I think that, I mean, I'm not saying everyone, like, I think getting your concealed carry is a good thing, but, I don't say it's like a necessary thing to have.
You could expand that to take precautions in ways that you're comfortable with, whether that's carrying pepper spray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whatever you need to do to give you that sense of,
or just situational awareness.
Yes.
Those types of things.
Absolutely. And I think, just that maintaining that level of safety mm-hmm. and trying to be aware. I mean, I'm always, I would say, pretty situationally aware in terms of like the gumbo mud was definitely a faulty there, but, but otherwise,
he'll sneak up on the best of us.
Yeah. Right? I know, right. But you know, when you're back at the hotel, making sure like, I mean, people are usually really nice that you stop and talk to and whatnot, but I keep my conversations as bland as I can sure. while being kind, you know, and things like that. I'm not giving them a lot of details mm-hmm. about who I am, who I'm with, things like that. Mm-hmm. I found that being a female walking with it into a hotel with her bird dog and a shotgun does gain some decent amount of attention.
Sure.
So trying to just limit that as mm-hmm. much as possible. And I do that as much as I can when I'm going places. And two, when you're, I mean, there's trailheads that are really far back in mm-hmm. making sure that you're not picking up a tail. Those are just really weird things that I personally keep an eye out for.
Yeah. And, but at the same time, unfortunately in today's day and age, particularly for a woman, those are mm-hmm. things you have to keep in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So, those are just some different things I would say that from a safety standpoint that I do my best to prepare for. In general, it's not really much you can do besides, like you said, if you don't have a conceal and carry, but you want to carry something, pepper spray is a fantastic tool. And that way you just have it, right?
Sure.
And then from there, I mean, just book the trip. Honestly, find a weekend. Yeah. Find a weekend that you can go. Find that you have a few days. Usually it takes, if you're wanting to go somewhere from my, you know, standpoint, I can get to North Dakota even and do some great hunting within, or South Dakota, within like 4 or 5 hours. It doesn't have to be ages away from you. Mm-hmm. Pick somewhere that doesn't seem too far away, that's tangible, and do the trip.
Yeah.
And that's like truly the best advice I can give. If you even have an inkling of a, you know, or a hunkering for it where it sounds kind of mm-hmm. intriguing, just do it.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that folks don't realize, I have a feeling you'll agree with this. How many birds you shoot has nothing to do with the reward.
Gosh, no.
It's the like going go and there, figuring it out.
Yes. The fact that you go out there and you get to come back with all these cool stories. And yeah. I think that's the hardest part too. When I think about stories and coming back, mm-hmm. coming back is always very hard for me, even if it's been a 3-day trip or a 5-day trip, or it doesn't matter the length, going on a solo trip will change your life, because you have memories and experiences that are yours mm-hmm. and no one else's.
Yeah.
And unfortunately it also means they're really hard to share about. Like, unless someone has done it as well, like you and I could probably share about and like mm-hmm. have at least a relation for, because we've both done it. But a lot of people are kind of like, cool, you know, when you try and tell them about it, they just don't have a concept of it, unfortunately. But I think that almost at first that was a hard part for me to deal with, of like, I can't tell people about what has happened because they don't get it. But, as I've learned about it, it's made the experiences sweeter for me, where it's now, oh, these are mine, you know, like God provided in this way, or I got to watch Redland do this mm-hmm. or all these things. And that's mine.
Yeah. No, as well as there's the whole personal growth and challenge and working through the unknown and failure and all those mm-hmm. types of things. But in today's day and age, there's something to be said for doing it without, you know, like doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
And And yeah, you hit the nail on the head that if you haven't done it, you don't, it's hard to get. And yeah, particularly in bird hunting, I mean, it's generally a team sport, right, so to speak. It's mm-hmm. a group activity. So doing it alone,
yeah,
adds in, you know, different layers. Uh-huh. And it's for a while there, probably until this season for me, but with work and my roles and different things and just this trips on the books, I didn't get a lot of time to mm-hmm. hunt from, even just, I'm going to go take the dog after work.
Right.
And this past season, I finally got back to that a little bit, and mm-hmm. it is awesome to yeah. just go out and I also make a point, like, I'm going to leave my phone in the truck. Mm. So that's like, while impressive. I don't, while I don't, while I don't have, yeah, but while I don't have photos.
Yes.
I have those experiences, and mm-hmm. it makes you pay attention a little bit more.
Yeah.
And really think, and gives your brain room to breathe a bit mm-hmm. more. And, yeah. And that's, I recognize too, that there's a safety risk there, and also some, you know, privilege, if you will, just to be able to be like, you know what, the hell with it. I'm mm-hmm. leaving the phone in the truck. But mm-hmm. there's also part of me where, like, the sort of, like the eye back to the older generation, yes, like they didn't like have phones, and if they broke a leg, they crawled out. They'll yeah. figure it out.
Well, thankfully, we have our Garmins, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can always hit the SOS button yeah. if you need to. So, man, that's I didn't have that on the list, but I'm glad that yeah, we
I'm
went
glad
there
you did too. I think like one other thing I would say too, if you're looking to grow with your dog,
yeah,
like grow closer with your dog. I mean, you can. Some people really care about closest with their mm-hmm. pets and stuff. That trip changed Redlands in my relationship as well. So okay. like, if that is something, if you're like, oh, I'm really looking to like connect with my dog and like get our hunting thing figured out more, mm-hmm. go on a trip with them, because they will rely on you in a sense that they've never relied on you before. Sure. 'Cause they're in a new space. They're realizing like you've picked them up and you've put them somewhere new, and yes, they're still going to do the thing of bird hunting that they know how to do well, but they're not in that same, like, this was entirely different terrain he'd mm-hmm. never been in. This was entirely different cover. And he did look to me for direction more. And like, it totally changed our yeah. relationship. So
nice.
That's one other thing I'd say about it.
No, I love it. Perfect. Man, where do I want to go from here? There's so much to cover.
We're going to have enough time.
yeah, that's the beauty of this. I'm more like, I'll let this thing run as long as I want it to. I don't care.
Going to be a part two. Nah.
She's like, just go Rogan style. It'll be 3 hours. All right. I want to circle back. You and I have had some conversations about faith mm-hmm. and your relationship with God and higher power and how you find that outside.
Yeah.
I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh gosh. Well, I grew up, I'll kind of start a little bit more at the beginning.
Okay.
Because I think it helps. 'Cause a lot of people might relate to this. I grew up going to church, but never knowing who Jesus was.
Okay.
More specifically. And just, it never got talked to me. Like, I mean, the gospel. If you don't know what the gospel is, you can reach out to me on Instagram or whatever. But gospel is basically, in a nutshell, the Lord loved you so much that he sent his son to die for you and save you from your sins. And we get to accept that grace freely. So if you, like I said, if you have more questions about that, you can always reach out to me. But and I don't know if I have any answers, but I will do my best. So I grew up in going to church, and then when I was in my teens, really started feeling like there's got to be more. Mm-hmm. There's more to me, more to this, more to life. So I started doing kind of some searching, ended up going to a youth group that a friend had suggested, and that really set my life on a faith course of mm-hmm. like, here's how Jesus can change your life. So then I learned about Jesus and accepted him into my life, and have since been trying to maintain, obviously you don't have to earn his grace and his love, but, trying to model what it means to be a Christian in the way that I act and do things mm-hmm. so that other people might learn about him through me. Mm-hmm. So that's been kind of my philosophy on my faith and whatnot. There was obviously some bumps in the road with that relationship that I sure. brought up earlier, that really took me away from things, and put me in some dark places. Even after I got out of that relationship, it was like, God, I don't know where you're at. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you relate to me. I was really stuck, and he did help me through that. I, unfortunately, at the time didn't understand it. And it has taken lots of reflecting since then to see yeah. where he worked, and had his hand intertwined in those moments in my life. Had an eating disorder in high school into college. Again, me kind of being like, God, where are you at? Like, I'm really struggling here mm-hmm. and you're not helping. I want you to take this away. He did eventually free me of that disorder. And I believe that was entirely under his power or within his power to do so. And again, it took me a little bit to figure that out. And even still to this day, there's times when I say, God, I don't know where you're at. I don't know. Uh-huh. And lately, my relationship with God has been learning that it's not where God's at, but where I'm at. And this is a funny, like, people say this all the time of like, God doesn't move, you do, or whatever. Like, but it is really true. There's been a lot of times that I've been in church or I've heard someone say something faith related. I'm rolling my eyes like, whatever, that doesn't apply to me, or, mm-hmm. or no one, they don't understand my circumstances. Like, they don't know how low I've been. They don't know how anxious I've been, but you're right. Like, you're right. They, like, those people don't, but there is someone who does, and mm-hmm. his name is Jesus.
Sure.
and so, yeah, God has just utilized the outdoors so many times to bring me back to him and say, I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'm here. I'm here, over and over again. And I've needed every reminder that he sent me.
Yeah.
because it's so easy to think, God, where are you at? Like, I'm struggling, and where are you? And he just is constantly saying to you, like, I'm here. And he whispers it in the wind. I see it in my dog. I see it in my husband. I see it in the trees and the birds and the things you get provided for every single day. And him just saying, I'm here, through his breath of nature. Mm-hmm. And actually, like, in Nina's Nature, my name on Instagram, Nina's, it has apostrophe S, like, as if it's my ownership of nature. Like, I own nature, but really, like, the inspiration from it came from, like, it's in my nature to be out in nature. Like, it's in my nature to, mm-hmm. You know, be out where I find and meet God the most.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where that name came from. Some people think I'm trying to be like possessive of nature.
Yeah. I didn't take it that way. So I'm
but yeah. So that's kind of,
thank you for offering the alternate perspective,
but yeah, so that's kind of where that came from. But yes. And it just seems like it's just a constant reminder for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously I just talked about earlier about how God utilized nature to bring me out of that bad relationship. And there's just been time and time again that it's continued to be very evident, that he utilized nature to speak with me. And I'm so thankful that that's what I get to be out doing and enjoying because of that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. It is, I've shared with you, I've rekindled my faith here mm-hmm. in the last handful of years, and I'm as I was listening to you, I didn't want to interrupt because I wanted to hear where you were. No, I wanted you to get where you were going, and I as you were talking, I was like, is she gonna talk about, like, it's not like where God is, it's where she is, like, because that for me, like, that's it was awesome to have you, like, come sort of full circle mm-hmm. with that, because that's, I think that is where I went as well, mm-hmm. of like, through a host of different personal experiences. I was like, this isn't it.
Yeah.
And since then it has been very like, oh no, but I'm just not paying attention,
mm-hmm.
or not doing what I need to do, or not being how I need to be to model those things.
Yeah.
And I, I told you this. I haven't said this publicly. Like, literally, I'm doing this podcast because I literally was driving down I-94 and had a conversation, was having a conversation with God about doing this podcast and a very particular way that God speaks to me. And he was like, "You're effing doing it." I'm like, "Okay." And that was like a month ago. And here we are, five episodes in. So, yeah. And it has, I think, constantly about, I love it. I love doing it. We were talking before we put the microphones on. Like, this is, I love hearing folks' stories and for everybody listening, like, your feedback, is so wonderful and heartwarming. And it really is just a very, like, telling and affirming for me of, like, oh, hey, dipshit, pay attention. Cause, like, he has your best interest in heart.
Yes.
And so here we are. So I'm glad we get to chat about that a little bit. There's way more there to be had. And I'm looking forward to exploring that with folks that are willing to talk about it. Cause it is, I was with some friends this weekend judging, and we were joking about, you know, like, church and being outside, and I have very much subscribed from, like, I'm in it, like Tony Jones writes about this in his book, like, I'm way closer to God outside on a Sunday morning than I am sitting in church. That's different for everybody, but that you need to figure out how that shows up. And I think, to your point about what I'm trying to say is that there's a big through line, like, with conservation, you know, how we started this conversation about like giving back into the landscape, because that is creation, and how we take care of that is a broader manifestation of our relationship. And
absolutely.
So, you know, if I find my connection there, if you do, how, I've said this in a number of different ways, like, how selfish of us to not take care of that for future generations and deprive, you know, those in the womb of time, as Teddy Roosevelt talks about, of that space to have those connections. Yes. Because it's so much harder to do that in an urban environment. Mm-hmm. Whereas you can really experience that creation.
Oh, so tangible. You know,
When you're outside. So, awesome. Hard pivot.
Talk to
me about starting a business.
Oh, gosh. Not that hard of a pivot. That takes a lot of faith.
I guess so. That's fair. You probably touché.
Experience as well.
Yes, it does.
So, business. Well, Pheasant Fest was a fantastic catalyst for all of this, to start a media business. Pheasant Fest this year, as in, what, 3 months ago?
Yeah.
This year, 2-3 months ago. Yeah. So it's been all very fast moving. I was a nurse. If anyone doesn't know, I was a nurse in my former career path. Mm-hmm. And I was a nurse for 5 years. And it ran its course for the time being. Mm-hmm. I was feeling exhausted. I was feeling burnt out. I tried to make different changes in my schedule and in my, like, setting and all that, you know, hospital or clinic or whatnot. And I just couldn't re-spark what was there. Mm-hmm. And obviously I've been doing the social media thing. That's a very generic thing to call it, but I've been, you know, doing a social media account, working on growing that for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the same time that I was a nurse, and that was just, I mean, I loved it, but I mentioned this a little bit in some different Instagram posts of, I didn't necessarily want to sell myself as a service, like as an influencer, if you will.
Sure.
I wanted to provide something to people that was beautiful and unique and creative. And for a time I thought that was writing. I still love writing. And I enjoy doing it, but I found that when I was trying to do that for other people, it lost its luster because I really did it for myself.
Boy, do I know that.
Yeah. I mean, I know you struggle with some of that too sometimes. Yeah. And, that was an attempt at a business idea of, like, oh, I should do writing and I can do that on the side of being a nurse. And that was just not it. And so then at Pheasant Fest, when I was getting asked by different brands or companies, like, how do you do this media stuff? Or how do you make social media posts? Or how do you get these kind of pictures? Why aren't you doing this full time? then it was, yeah, it was just like a smack in the face as I was talking to people of like, this is it. This is what I need to do. And again, I thought it was going to be like on the side. And then I think it was within a few weeks, maybe after that, my husband, who I hadn't really like, I think we've both been thinking about it individually, but had yet to really come together and say, I really want to do this.
Yeah.
What do you think? And he just kind of said out of the blue, I think you should quit your job if you want to and pursue this. And I was, my husband's a pretty stable guy, if you could say that. So like, this was a pretty wild idea coming from him, especially because as I was thinking about it, I was the one thinking like, there's no way I could ever do this. Like no way this could work out. And so when he suggested it, it was like, oh, so this could actually happen. We could actually do this.
Yeah.
So we started talking about it a lot more. And then, not long after that, just a few days after that, my mother-in-law and I are very close. And I hadn't really said again, like too much to her about it as well. She was like, Nina, you seem very passionate about this. I really think God's calling you in this direction. Like you need to quit your job. It's like, oh my gosh, I think you really need to quit your job.
Yeah.
And again, it was like, oh my gosh, like this is really like smacking me in the face here. And so then there was like a couple hard weeks at work and I just kept thinking and thinking and thinking. I was doing a lot more business stuff as I was getting some of this ramping up of like doing it on the side. And it just got to a point of like a breaking point of like, this is taking up a ton of time while I'm still trying to do my normal job. And I came home one day and I looked at Mark and I was like, so April 8th, how does that sound? He was like, that's the day you're going to be done. I was like, that's it. He was like, all right, let's do it. So I like turned in my 2 weeks and we started planning and yeah, talk about a mix of emotions though. I mean, starting a business is, I think everyone goes through this. If you start a business of like, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. Did I capitalize on that opportunity just right? Did I say the right thing? Should I have communicated differently? Did I post enough?
5:30 in the morning. Have you been in my brain?
Right. Yeah. Like, it's pretty much how every day that I wake up, I think about that. And exactly what I'm finding is like the more people I talk to about this that have started a business, they're like, that's normal, you know? And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So I can stop like sobbing about it. It's normal.
Well, I sob about it. I mean, get it out. Yeah.
It's been a huge mix of emotions. And like one moment you feel like you're on cloud nine of like, this happened. And then the next day you're like, but did I do that right? You know, I'm sure I'll feel the same way when we get done this with this podcast of like, this was so great. And then like tomorrow I'll be like, oh gosh, should I say that correctly? And like, it's going to be up in the world.
I think you did great.
So business, entrepreneurship, all that is incredibly difficult and rewarding in the weirdest ways.
Yeah. Well, but at the same time, I mean, you're doing what I did, which is I'm following passion.
Yeah.
And it is meaningful and there's a direction that I want to go in and I have goals and I know you do too. And there's a reason behind that. And it's to share this thing that we love, that we want other people to get the most out of.
Absolutely.
And that is an incredible driver. Mm. I said this on the episode with Jake. My metric for success is when I can call Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever or Rough Grouse Society and go, what are we doing? Mm. Like what piece of land do we need to buy? What piece of property needs habitat improvement?
That's awesome.
What program do we need to bolster for public access?
And then when you do that, you call me and I'll be there for media.
You can
coverage.
Do all the media and all of those types of things. I think a lot about legacy.
Mm. We both talked about that word quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think I've shared this publicly. One part I have. So I think about, I read something once that talked about grief. And how grief is best processed through legacy. And for folks that know me personally, I've had some unique experiences related to death, both in persons and in dogs in my life. And I carry that. And it's a big through line through what I do and what I write about. And and just it's a sort of a constant. And I think a lot about this business as an opportunity to fulfill legacy and process that grief, and to ensure that lessons that were taught to me by those that aren't here anymore carry on and get passed on to other people. And also in the other side of legacy, I don't necessarily know that children are in my future. Most likely not. And I'm very comfortable with that at this point. And at the same time, when I went through that reckoning, if you will, I very quickly in my brain went like, all right, so how do you work in the world to leave the world a better place? Because there won't be anybody like in your genetic train, right, to come after you. And I think about that. Like, I think about how can I personally make a difference in other people's lives as well as on the landscape to leave it better than I found it. And it's such a privilege to wake up every day and do that. And in conversation with you, that we have a lot of similarity around that, you know, that not necessarily like the grief and the children piece, but just the end goal of like, I want this to be way better than when I started.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely say that's a huge piece for me. My husband and I were just talking about, so we're in a farming community. And so Pheasants Forever can have some controversial impacts.
For sure.
And we were talking about one of like our farming friends that is like, oh, taxes and all this stuff. And hopefully, I don't think he's going to listen to this episode, but probably not, but taxes and this and that. And I was like, I guess I just care more about what it does for the land. Like, this maybe is just not very far. Like, I don't know. It's for the people that have money concerns. It's probably not very conscientious of that, but I care so much more about what we can leave, like you said, in terms of providing land and providing space for people to enjoy it and providing birds the places to grow and foster in it. And I just find it so beautiful too. Like, I mean, I can go on a drive on the countryside and see all these like pieces of land that have been re-put back into their natural habitat. And I just find it so incredible. And I just care so much more about that than I do like maybe some added taxes or some politics that go with it. And I think people are going to see that passion of positivity more than they're going to see the passion of negativity of like, oh, look at the bad things it's done to our tax bracket. But look at how beautiful this land is.
And think about how much better your water quality is and how much less soil erosion you have.
Oh my gosh.
And like, candidly, like from a bottom dollar perspective, like look at how much better your bottom line is when you're not burning diesel in a combine through marginal crops because it's all low-lying wetland. It's been soaking wet all year.
Like I think there's a fantastic balance that can exist between ag and between conservation. And if more people would be open, that's a message that I wish I could bring to more of the ag community, because I think there's just so much negativity is towards like conservation efforts, is the fact that like I think there can be a balance if we're open to it. And you know, if you take a truly strategic look at your property of where are the low lying, or where's the areas that aren't producing that we could put back into something else that would be producing, or you know, a winter crop or just different thing, a cover crop to avoid erosion, different things like that. That I think those topics, change is hard, right? And like people don't want to admit that, they don't want to admit that it's a good thing if it requires them, you know, kind of rescinding on a previous stance that they had. Yeah. So I just wish that there was more people willing to take on that change.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine this weekend who is very involved in the agricultural industry and travels all over the world. And I think he said this, it's in Australia. That there are parts of Australia that for conservation, they require 10% of their agricultural landscape to be in native habitat.
Interesting.
And I have a friend that I hunt with in Kansas a bit who's broached this idea. And it's I would love to see this come to fruition, the political and business and personal philosophy hurdles and ramifications would be tremendous to get over. But if you were to think about what it would mean for 10% of every farm grounds piece of property to be habitat, hey, think about just like the number of acres that would create, and also think about the amount of habitat connectivity that would create. Yeah. How much buffer, how much you would basically recreate our fence rows from 80 years ago.
Yeah.
And what would that do? Mm-hmm. You know, 80 to 100 years ago. Like, this is super selfish from a bird hunting perspective.
It is, but, right.
But what would that do to the landscape in terms of what we take off of it and what we keep in it and put back into it? Yeah. And carbon sequestration and water quality and all the things. It boggles my mind driving around and still seeing hedgerows come out for another couple acres of ag crop. And so,
right. I know,
you know, as well as then, you know, I live an hour south of the cities and watching, you know, ag fields then turn into housing developments.
Yes. And like the encroachment. Yeah. Or it's expansion, however you want to say it.
It's a, you know, the world, the reality is the world will look very different for us in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And so the more we can do to preserve and conserve some of those places, the better.
Yeah.
Okay. Should probably stop ranting.
It's all right. That was a good tangent.
No, it's something it's I'm very, really care about. Very passionate about. Yeah. I grew up in the Northeast, so not a lot of publicly accessible land. And at the same, like, I can think of pieces of property that my dad told me that he hunted pheasants on that are housing developments. And now I can think of pieces of property that I knew I used to drive by that were farms that I used to look for deer in the fields that are now housing developments. Yeah. And that's everybody has one of those tales. Mm-hmm. And so will our kids, so will their generation. And so
unfortunately,
we need to be smart about what that looks like in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. Lightning round.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Which is, I'm learning, is not very lightning, but that, or it's a long storm is what I told somebody the other day. It's a long storm. What do you know now that you wish that you knew when you started with Redlin?
Ooh. I still think that the lesson of patience is the one that drives home. Mm-hmm. Like, that has permeated through every part of my training. And the sooner I could learn that lesson, the better I was for him. I would say if you're planning to get a bird dog, if you already have a bird dog, it's not going well. Mm-hmm. Take a look inward.
Yeah.
And say, it's not the dog's fault, like, most of the time. they're maliciously trying to do things wrong. Mm-hmm. They have good intentions most of the time. What am I doing wrong? Most likely you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And how am I not fostering this?
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that lesson of patience and inward focus in my dog training has been massive.
Okay. I like that. That's perfect. What's a resource that's been really impactful and helpful for you in, as you've learned to upland hunt or to train your dog?
I would say, like I said, that reaching out eventually to that dog trainer that was local to me, he became a great friend, a great mentor, and not being afraid to ask for help. So like, obviously there's lots of good podcasts, there's lots of good books, but if you can reach out to someone, it doesn't even have to be necessarily in person. If you've got someone you follow online that seems, you know, reputable and seems to have a good stance on dog training, and you just need some pointers because you're trying to do it DIY, but you're running into some hiccups, like, reach out and find that group. It doesn't have to be big. It can be, you can have a one person dog community or two people or whatever. like my, I had my one person as my mentor, and I didn't really have like a, we don't have much for like a dog training community around mm-hmm. us, at least not unless you're doing like trial testing and stuff. Sure. And I wasn't interested in that. So I was just looking for like a hunting dog style community. And if you can find, doesn't have to be much, but if you can find that yeah. and foster it, your training will change and your dog perspective will change.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, it broadened horizons.
Yeah.
That's a, that's this asking these types of things. And like the, what you know now that you didn't know then has been really helpful. I've gotten a lot of feedback from folks mm-hmm. of like, oh, I don't feel alone.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's different than when somebody is standing across from you going, oh no, I've been there and yeah. I get where you're at right now and yeah. we'll work through it. So sweet. What's your favorite piece of gear?
Ooh, probably my vest.
Okay.
Ooh, but then again, I love my, oh gosh, it's hard.
It is hard.
I did not realize this was going to be hard of a question. Oh, it's a toss-up. My shotgun, my Siren L4S, that okay. like totally changed my life in terms of my ability to hunt fitted successfully. Shotgun. Yes, a oh. well-fitted shotgun. Like, I love all the other things I wear, but I truly wouldn't be able to hunt without my gun. And it took a long, long time to find it. But now that I've got it, I'm very, very happy.
Awesome.
And it just makes your shooting, you, like, you just become more confident.
Yeah.
And now I can, like, gosh, even just this, I just, our clay shooting league locally just started recently, and I'm on a team. And last year, my first score, as I was gun shopping and trying new shotguns, I got a score of 7 out of 50 when mm-hmm. I first went. 7. Like, not that that's, not that that matters, but I couldn't hit anything. Like, sure. I could not hit anything. Yeah. And this year, after I don't think I've shot anything since February, and I got a score of 39. Like,
impressive.
Like, I was very happy with that. And yeah. It's just all happened. And it wasn't a matter of, oh, I had to try super hard. I had to, no, like the right fit will make things feel so natural. You won't be blasting your shoulder out. You won't, yeah. like, I have a massive concussion history. Mm. So I have to be really careful with the guns that I shoot. And not having pain every time I shoot is really nice.
Sure.
So yeah. I just think a shotgun changes things.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. I like that. Perfect. What would you put on Redlands tag to get back to you?
Oh gosh. You mean the dog tags that you,
yeah.
Oh goodness. My first, oh gosh. We've got so many like inside jokes with him. Like, one of his nicknames is Louie. So like, probably would say something like, we'll respond to Louie. Otherwise, I don't know.
Mm.
I can't. I'm not one of those people that it would take me a long time to think of something catchy enough to
gotcha.
Come up with one of those
tags.
What
are his flaws?
Oh. Oh, yeah. Like, whenever he's anxious, like, he'll sit there and yawn over and over again. And, like, he literally, like, if you've heard, like, a cow elk.
Mm-hmm.
He sounds like that over and over and over again. So like, if you know Redland's irritated with you or mm-hmm. wants to get going, like, yeah, basically like if you're in
he's
the woods
mouthy.
And he, yeah, if you're out hunting and you start hearing an elk and you don't see one, it's probably him.
Okay. Yeah.
That's, drives me nuts.
That's very fair. All right. If you weren't to get a lab next, what are breeds you're curious about?
Ooh, it's a hot topic. I'm contemplating.
Okay.
Yeah. I love Cockers. I think
okay.
Cockers, which I think I've told you this before. Mm-hmm. I think Cockers are really cool.
Yep.
I love how little they are, and I love that they just are balls of energy.
Yeah,
and
Cracked Spaniels.
Yeah, and they also just have so much drive. So anytime I've ever seen a Cocker in the field, I just love the way they work.
Mm-hmm.
But if I was to choose a pointer, I would be probably in like the red setter realm.
Okay.
Because I just am a softy for red dogs, I guess.
Yeah.
And I appreciate a good setter tail. And
mm-hmm.
I think they just have a lot of, I love their stamina. And that's something that we struggle with Redland is we think he might have gotten a little too hot at one point when he was a puppy.
Yeah.
And probably my fault. I just wish he had a little bit more oomph and like the ability to maintain his energy level throughout the day when it's a little warmer out. So I kind of wish I had just a little bit different dog that could handle a bit of the warmer temperatures.
Yeah. Oh, it's hard, right? You planned for the cold.
Yeah. Right. So. Exactly. I got what I wanted.
Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah. So I would say those two.
My buddy Ryan, who listens to the podcast, is doing a happy dance now because you said Red Setter, and he has one. And
yeah.
He's prodding me to... He jokes that it's the best Red Setter that I've judged in NAVDA, which he's not wrong. It's also the only Red Setter that I've judged in NAVDA.
So. Might have to meet this dog.
It's a very nice dog. Yeah, very, very nice dog. I want to say what's that kennel? Qantas Red Setters? Very well built.
Yeah. I've gone hunt, like my friend from Montana, I have a friend in Montana. She has a Red Setter and a English Setter. And I love hunting with both of them, but mm-hmm. I do have a soft spot for that Red Setter. She's just beautiful.
Yeah. They're good looking.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. I'm going to give you a curveball. What questions do you have for me?
Ooh, no, I, when you texted me about like, what did you want to talk about? And I said, well, we've got like, I feel like our conversations always go to like faith and business and like doing hard things. How are you handling, like when you have a tough spot in a business, a day of mm-hmm. business, which I know I feel like they happen every day. How are you like recentering and like, how are you getting back on focus?
That's a good question. I think I know, I'm trying to articulate this well. The number one thing for me is routine.
Oh.
And that working for myself has fostered a level of discipline mm-hmm. and routine that I always used to get down on myself that I didn't think that I had, and I mm-hmm. do. I just needed the motivation to achieve it.
Yeah.
I actually think a lot about that, like in the context of dog training, that mm-hmm. a lot of it is discipline and routine.
Yeah.
And we are at our best selves, you know, training and whatnot when we do have that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try really hard to pivot back to like, because what happens is if it's particularly bad, it's because I'm out of my routine. Mm-hmm. So I try really hard to pivot back to what that looks like in terms of physical health and those mm-hmm. types of things, as well as the single biggest problem that I experience is it doesn't go fast enough. You mentioned patience. Like I am horribly impatient and, I am constantly learning that I have to slow down and take advantage of things outside of work and to like shut my brain off. And some of that's the dog, and which is funny, right? Because they're related, but, taking the dog for a walk or the other, like I just went to the park the other day and did pile work, and like nice. I just needed to go for the walk and to go do that. Finding, like, creating time to go do things that you know are like restorative for you mm-hmm. is really important in anything. And I would say this, to bring it back to why folks are listening from a bird dog perspective, like. You can burn out dog training. Mm-hmm. So make sure that you build in time to like, that's probably something that I see a lot of people do is they get so focused on the outcome that they forget that it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And they don't make it fun for their dog either.
Right. It's just work, work, work.
And I have said this before, I think there's so many parallels between like dog training and bird hunting and business. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely one of them is you have to create time for fun.
Mm-hmm.
You have to create time for your relationships.
Yeah.
And honestly, doing this is a part of it. I forgot how much I love like hearing people's stories and telling people's stories and asking questions and learning more about people. And at the same time, I guess so finding what I enjoy doing and creating more opportunities to do that. And knowing, Chris Williamson talks about this he does the Modern Wisdom podcast. Mm-hmm. If you don't listen to that, I really recommend it. He talks about, like, for everything that you love doing in your business, you have to realize that there's the things that you hate, that if you don't do those things, then you don't get to do the thing that you love. Mm. And so look at it as like a feature, not a bug.
Yes.
Like, I hate email, but you have to do it, you know? And it's like, and that's a feature, not a bug. Because if I don't do email, then
none of this,
we don't schedule a podcast. Yeah, that's a really great question. It's something I struggle with a lot. Yeah. And I struggle with it. You'll run into this too, like from a passion perspective, because it is my life. Mm-hmm. So, you're always on.
Oh, yeah.
And you're always thinking about stuff. And it's really, you have to like almost train your brain of like, no, we're not doing that right now. Mm-hmm. We got to focus on this thing. So,
no, that's so true. This is probably maybe, I don't think it's necessarily a quote or anything, but that idea of if you are trying to do so many tests at once, like nothing really truly gets done.
Yeah.
And that idea of like, if I see my phone ping with like a notification of social media that I need to answer back, or an email from business that I need to answer back, like, and I'm in the middle of a workout or something, like you got lucky and you called me yesterday during a workout and I actually answered. Yeah. But a lot of times, unless someone's calling me, I do my best to say, no, I'm dealing with that during my business time.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're, an email, and I got to work on lunch, and I got to I got to do this little laundry, and things get done, but you're never moving in a direction.
Yeah.
And I think that's been something I've learned already, or trying to learn already quickly.
Yeah. Another thing, I heard this just recently, going back to that Chris Williamson podcast, he just interviewed Tim Ferriss, and they started the conversation talking about efficiency versus effectiveness.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh, that's legit. Especially too in let's apply it to training in this, and so zoom out and apply it to anything. You see this a lot in the NAVDA world, like everybody at a training day wants three birds to go do field work because it's like sexy. And no one's doing like pile retrieving or doing duck drags or healing or training their dog to come to them. And it's like, cool, you're being efficient, but you're not being effective. You're not working on the big picture things that are going to really move you and your dog training forward.
Yeah.
And it's the same in business. Working on probably my worst days are the ones where at the end of the day, I'm like, I did a lot today and I didn't accomplish anything.
Yeah. Those are the worst for sure.
Yeah.
They're the hardest to reflect on.
Yeah, absolutely. Nina, this was fantastic. I really appreciate your candor. you shared some deeply personal stuff. So that takes a lot of courage. Thank you.
Willingly stepped in and said, I'm an open book, Mike.
But still, people say that and they also have guardrails. I love what you're doing. I've been a fan of your social media and your presence in the space. You're a fantastic role model, and an inspiration. I think you're willing to do the things that a lot of people aspire to do. And I think that is needed in our community to have, particularly from a female perspective, to have representation of somebody that's going to drive halfway across the country to go hunt birds with their dog.
Yeah.
That story needs to be told, and I'm glad that you're telling it. I'm super proud of you for taking the leap and the business front. It's scary, but I'm excited to see what is to come for you. Thank you so much for sitting down. Where can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So Instagram is my primary platform. It's @in.ninas.nature is my Instagram handle. And then if you're into Facebook, you can look up the same thing and find it as well.
Awesome. So, perfect. Yeah. Well, folks, I'm sure folks will recognize you from some of the stuff that you've done with Ugly Dog. You did some of our Garmin how-to videos, which were super well received. I'm sure we'll be doing more of those. And I really look forward to doing more work with you in the future. Mm-hmm. In the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Ugly Dog Podcast. If you liked it, please leave us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you use. And if you didn't, shoot me an email at info@uglydoghunting.com and share how I can make it better. Also, check out uglydoghunting.com for all your bird dog needs. Happy hunting!